coming to you from the West Coast. This is Politicoast. Today is October 6, 2017, and this is episode 55. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Today, we're going to be talking about the Vancouver Council by-election forum we went to last night. Jagmeet Singh's sort of surprise victory and first ballot as NDP leader, our open invitation to Seth Rogen to come on the show and talk electoral reform and, I guess, cannabis legalization, obviously, and just our usual quick takes. First, we have to thank our premier sponsor, Lindsay Tedds, for helping make this show possible and helping make it possible for us to afford these fancy mics we're now using and trying to figure out. We also missed this past week our first year anniversary. We put our first episode on the internet on September 30th, 2016. There was a teaser attempt to the week before that, but our first episode one was September 30th. Don't go back and listen to it. I tried. It's not that good. We didn't have intro music. We couldn't really string sentences together or flow without awkward pauses and things like that. We just had one mic. The audio wasn't terrible, but hopefully it's not as good as this. It's all still there if you want to go back, because
the internet never forgets.
There we go. Segment one, where should you house your vote? As I mentioned last night, we were at the West End Homeless and Housing Forum, put on by a cadre of groups, including friend of the pod, Micah, and his law firm, and Metro Vancouver Alliance, and the West End Seniors Network, and I think a neighborhood house, and maybe one or two other groups. You can find the full debate. It's on our feed on the episode before this. It's just over 2 hours, so if you want to get the takes from the major five candidates, some of the independents and Watermelon weren't invited, so you'll have to find their websites if you want to find out what they're about. But what did you think of the night?
Overall, I thought it was a pretty good event, well run, and you know, props to the organizers for setting it up, and to the moderators who did a pretty good job and were in some ways more entertaining at times than the actual candidates.
Yeah, I heard one candidate mentioned, this is hearsay, like second or third hand, but apparently one candidate told an organizer and random other people it was the best run debate forum thing she'd ever been to, which is pretty high praise. Some of these can go a bit off the rails, and this was a pretty smooth night. It was great to have Tom Davidoff there. He's past guest of the show from somewhere in the summer. We had him talk about housing policy, and so he knows his stuff inside and out. And he naturally used that to quiz the candidates on compound interest questions.
Yeah, that was one of the more amusing parts of the night, is when the skill testing question came up.
No one answered it. Well, I guess Pete Fry tried to put something forward, but we didn't find out if he was right.
I'm pretty sure he lowballed the number quite a bit.
Beyond that, it was a pretty standard forum. There was no chance for exchanges between the candidates, which I thought was one disadvantage. It gets awkward with five people on stage, and so it was more just the moderators testing each of the candidates, and they did follow up with detailed questions, which was really nice, and really tried to pin them down on things, as opposed to let them spout off in whatever direction they were going to go.
Yeah, the follow-up questions were great, and I particularly like Tom Davidoff whenever he'd try and get some really wonky question out there, and the economic professor came through.
He also, I think, has a very terrible poker face. When he heard questions being responded to in a way he liked, he tended to
grin,
look very positive, and other times he is kind of grimacing, but that's fine. The other moderator was UBC law professor Margot Young, who did a fantastic job as well for her part, bringing in sort of a balance of questions in there. For candidates, we had Vision's Diego Cardona, One City's Judy Graves, Independent / Cope nominated Gene Swanson, Green Party's Pete Fry, and NPA's Hector Bremner. I guess this was our first chance to really compare them both in person and against each other. Any standout / never Scots?
Yeah, there's definitely a couple nevers on that candidate pool for me. I think one of the standout moments came fairly early on when Gene Swanson pulled out a giant prop, which, you know, props aren't something that you see enough of in political debates. This was a tax bill for Chip Wilson's mansion, which I talked a little bit last week about how I'm not a huge fan of that line of rhetoric from her, but the prop was nevertheless appreciated.
It was hand-painted on a canvas banner. It's the episode art for the previous episode, at least on SoundCloud and the feed. It might not be on our website, but she basically stands up and awkwardly like rolls it over the table and pins it down so that everyone can just like look at that the entire evening, which was pretty fantastic, I agree. My favorite historical story of props, I think, was one Canadian Parliament issue when there was a fisheries debate going on in Atlantic Canada, and one MP came in with a dead fish and just slapped it down on a minister's desk and left this dead fish there. I think he got expelled for the day for that, but worth it.
Absolutely worth it.
So Gene Swanson makes not a fishy splash, but splash in terms of the props. I found she also, I think she mentioned it at one point, but she highlighted, or it was highlighted, how her campaign has basically set the tone for this by-election. When the questions coming up are about mansion taxes, are about rent freezes, these are the things that she basically put on the agenda from day one, and it made me realize how her campaign actually made a really good call for what she's trying to do in just getting out there early, in launching early with a bunch of big controversial ideas. And it gets the attention, where I found Judy Graves to be, by contrast, pretty soft-spoken, but not just in terms of literally had to move closer to the mic a number of times, but not like deep on policy, would sort of, I actually saw Judy clap along to a number of Gene Swanson's points. But then when it came time to commit to what would you do, Gene just said, well, we should look out for the lower income renters.
Well, she did have more policies than that, and sure, also better policies, in my opinion, than Swanson did. She talked a lot about how, you know, there was a need for a lot more rental accommodation, was more accepting of non-government provided rental accommodation too. Highlighted some of the problems in the Point Grey neighborhood with the issues around the zoning there. So she had a decent cross-section of ideas, and one of, I think, the better moments for me from her was when the rent freeze question came up. And for context, there was a large contingent of very loud Gene Swanson supporters, and you know, Judy Graves, with that kind of room and that kind of atmosphere, took a probably somewhat unpopular opinion in the room, at least, that the rent freeze wouldn't really work.
Yeah, I don't think it translates into the recording as well as it was in the room, but every time Gene Swanson would speak or be introduced, there was audible applause at every chance. Hector Bremner, I think, got one applause line, maybe just like the polite thank you for coming applause. And then that was the spectrum, with everyone else sort of in between. I think Pete Fry had the second most supporters there, just from the Greens.
So yeah, that was definitely a solid moment for her. And the rent freeze is one of those issues that I think really kind of separates the good candidates on policy from the bad candidates on policy. Although it is worth noting that the bunch of organizations sent around questionnaires to candidates, and one of them was the Tenants Union. And the response from one city to that was more favorable to those sorts of rent control issues. So I'm a little unclear what the actual position is, but
it depends, you know, who's asking, I guess.
That does seem to be the end result of it. So one of the things about Jean Swanson is she was very good at kind of hitting her talking points, really kind of stayed on message in a lot of cases, but wasn't all that great about dealing with some of the more pointed questions. The question got asked about, if the market does provide most of the housing, how are you going to potentially deal with not disrupting that new source of housing there? And she basically dodged the question.
Which was weird to me, because for her vision, as I see it, and the pitch she's trying to make is a more government-socialist-y style approach. And so her response to that should be, the problem is that the government isn't enough in housing, that too much of housing is being run by the market. Because I think Margot Young kept bringing that up, like, in Canada, we're more of our housing is provided by the market than any comparable country. And all Jean Swanson has to do is says, yes, that's the problem. And here's how I'll solve it: by tax the rich, build a bunch of social housing, problem solved.
Yeah,
magic and fairies. But
instead,
she was thin on that and a number of other kind of issues.
Yeah, it was
like she wouldn't even say whether her rent freeze was a absolute or nominal kind. Like, you pay $400 this year, you're going to pay $400. Well, no one pays $400. You pay $2,000 this year, you're going to pay $2,000 in 4 years, or if that's going to be inflation adjusted. She's like, it doesn't matter. It's just rent freeze for 4 years.
Yeah, it was some of those questions like that. And on the, one of those, I think it was the market housing, or it was the issue about rent control as a disincentive. It was basically, I'll call the bluff. That's not really a good answer, especially because those sorts of economic decisions happen based on the margins of it. And it's not a question of, can someone make any money? It's, well, if they have a choice with what to do with their money, why would they build rental housing rather than, say, buy stocks or build condos or any of these other sorts of things?
Like, I think she has a lot of the parts to make a stronger platform and a stronger message. Like, she could patch it together with additional kind of duct tape and things like, oh, well, if I put a rent freeze in, then to stop people from flipping rental housing to condos, we just have to put in another policy. And, you can just keep adding policies on and make this rickety socialist structure that,
Cardona actually works
enough for a platform when you're running as a single by-election council candidate who has no chance of affecting real policy if you win.
Yeah, and Cardona did that a bit with the, I back rent control with other stuff to incentivize rental housing. But yeah, the Jean Swanson just seems more militantly anti-market than anything else. And even the question of upzoning the West Side, which is such an obvious, there's a bunch of rich people here, use it, and the laws basically favor them by making it so only rich people can buy these detached single-family houses because that's the only thing that can be built here. Rather than the obvious, just let apartments be built there, it was, yes, but only for social housing. And it's just one of those things where it displays a lack of understanding of kind of how those sorts of mechanisms work in a much more rigidly ideological position from her.
I think it's just the campaign she's trying to run has that almost hashtag feel, like hashtag socialism. Here's the three policies she started on. She's going to stick with them. And anything that comes outside of that, she's just going to try to bring back and say, yeah, you've got your extra apartment idea. Well, whatever. We need social housing. We need government-run housing. Let's get a tax freeze, or let's get a rent freeze. These are the things we need to keep coming back to.
Yeah, but the moderators actually pushed her on that one and pretty pointedly asked, okay, who would be displaced if we upzoned the West Side? And there was no good answer to that. And yeah, there's kind of the, always try and bring back on message, but there's also times where that just looks really dodgy and disingenuous.
Well, and she was also saying we need to make sure housing is a right, and Tom Davidoff pushes back and says, a right for whom? Who should be able to live here? And she says, the people who live here, which is a bit of a tautology. And the problem I think he's trying to drag out is you put overly favorable conditions in place for renters, more people are going to want to come here and rent, making it even harder for the people who are here.
Yeah, and also, if housing's a right, you're dealing with a scarce resource here, which is government funds, construction workers, whatever the bottleneck is. There, at some point, there's going to have to be some version of rationing housing, and that wasn't really addressed in the kind of housing as a right. And that's one of, the major problems with commodity. I'm just going to use that in a general term. Whatever the thing is as a right is, you inevitably have to deal with the trade-offs of scarcity. And that wasn't really addressed. And buy her kind of positions on that.
But I guess the comparison I was making with Judy Graves, who is trying to come from a similar-ish place, is whoever wins, unless it's Diego, is going to be in opposition and probably won't be changing policy, but in terms of advocating for, let's call it the left of local politics, out of two of them, well, Vancouver politics center is to the left, and then you have the far left and you have like the centrist right. But Judy Graves just didn't strike me as as strong an advocate in terms of public speaking, in terms of making the case, even the case she was trying to make for herself. That's not to say she shouldn't win, but...
Yeah, being an advocate's part of the role of a city councilor, but also, you know, voting on policy is pretty important too, and I just don't see Gene Swanson as having anything approaching good policy. I mean, I'm sure her heart's in the right place, but basically every answer she gave was a reason not to vote for her, in my opinion, beyond the, well, her heart's in the right place sort of thing. Whereas Judy Graves, I disagree with her on some stuff. I think she's overselling the benefits of inclusionary zoning, but and a few things like that. But, you know, I feel like I could talk with her and we could get to a policy point where we can, you know, more or less kind of have a general agreement on where the city's going. And the conversation would be less about just, you know, beating the drum and more about, okay, this is where this is what we should do as a policy.
So we have those two. We had Diego Cardona, who's the 21-year-old, I believe, running for Vision. He's got an impressive resume for being 21. He's a Colombian refugee, has been involved on a number of youth advocacy organizations, and all of this is after being a child in care. But at the same time, he kind of came across, I think he had the hardest job at very least. So he's representing the governing party, doesn't have a huge record of his own, so he basically has to say, yeah, I'll keep doing what's been going on, but better.
He really is kind of the status quo candidate, so it's a tough thing to sell, especially in a forum of, you know, we have a housing problem. It's hard to sell the current government's record on it. And while he did some more ambitious stuff than Vision's been doing, like the SITS unit, quote-unquote Vancouver Special 2.0, you know, by and large, there just wasn't much there in terms of where the city should be going differently than it is now.
Yeah, he, I think, warmed up through the evening and had some charisma in there and was a likable enough candidate, but just got stuck with having to defend this record that's not his. On the other hand, then, we have Pete Fry, who's the repeat council candidate. I think this is only his second time, but he, I thought, had lots of technical policy. He would often get into subsections of bylaws, or I guess that was Gene Swanson kept bringing up, but Pete Fry would go into other things and start bringing up like, oh, and then in Sydney they're doing this, and then in Hong Kong they do this. So
he brought up Hong Kong. It was Hector Bremner talking about how Sydney has so many apartments, people are giving away iPads to convince tenants.
That's more of a Hector Bremner kind of point. We'll get to him. So Pete Fry brought up a number of very wonky things I found, which is interesting.
Yeah, he was the only person to mention land value taxes, which, you know, props to him for that.
And that's one of those Tom Davidoff is smiling kind of moments. And I think
Pete, any economist in the room probably was...
Well, Pete was definitely like playing into Tom. He's like, well, there was this group of esteemed economists that came up with some plans. I think there was good stuff in there.
Yeah, that was a little...
gushy, brown nosy.
Very brown nosy, in fact.
And I think the thing that worried both of us most about Pete Fry is just his general connection with the Greens. Like when he stands up and says, oh, if I'm on council, I can second every one of Adrian Carr's motions.
I think that was the one line he said that night that got kind of a audible from the crowd.
And for the larger context, especially those who don't follow Vancouver politics, Adrian Carr is our sitting Green councillor who, I mean, I kind of just did it there, has that like, puts forward the policies that kind of everyone wants to goes, all right, that's nice. You're being too green, almost too granola.
Except the weird times when she's not. Like, there was one council meeting I was at where she was concerned there wasn't enough parking at a development. And you know, it's not the sort of thing one would expect the notional environmentalist party to be the ones talking about. The Greens also are weirdly opposed to Broadway subway line, which is...
Yeah, he brought that up. He wants to put... What was his alternate plan? Like streetcars, essentially?
He wanted to further electrify the bus network instead of...
The Vancouver bus network that's almost 100% electrified already?
There's some non-electrified ones, but...
Right. It's pretty electrified to UBC, at least.
Yeah, it's... The main problem isn't there is enough electrification in the network. It's that the big diesel 99s are packed to the bursting, and we drastically need a subway.
So the Greens have their problems.
Yeah, the other kind of big green part of their platform is they want to bring in a bunch of neighborhood councils and that sort of stuff, which is just the sort of thing that's going to just give a bunch of taxpayer money to NIMBYs to be even more vocal and push it back against development.
The sympathetic argument to their side is having local democracy, having people at that local level make decisions. And that's a nice idealism.
In practice, though, those sorts of organizations tend to be a, well, we don't want whatever's happening to happen in our neighborhood. And, you know, it turns into a way of excluding people more than anything else. Oh, yeah, and the other weird thing was no market housing on transit-oriented development, which is also a little odd. Like, I can see the case to be made that, we should have some social housing near transit stations, but just a flat-out no market development was an odd position to take.
He did also pitch no more parking in developments by transit, right? That was his thing. And that one at least makes more sense because ideally, why do we have such absurd parking requirements for new developments?
You should ask Adrienne Carr that because apparently she's a fan.
And finally, there's Hector the Connector Bremner. Hector introduced us to his new nickname that we're going to use all the time because that's apparently what he was known as around the Ministry of Housing's offices in Victoria when he was a aide to Rich Coleman of the BC Liberals.
Yeah, so this was one of the most puzzling things anyone said during the night because Rich Coleman is not well liked in Vancouver.
Especially the West End.
Yes, and especially on housing issues, he was basically seen as a giant failure on the file, at least by the people in Vancouver. And if you're running on a housing-centric platform in Vancouver, pointing out how close you are to Rich Coleman was really not a good idea. And naturally, the follow-up question focused on that, which he dodged.
Well, they asked him to defend the Liberals' record of 16 years, since he was and is a BC Liberal. And he instead chose to focus on Vision Vancouver's record.
Yeah, and in his defense, Vision does do a lot of just blame the other levels of government and not actually focus on the tools they have at their hand. So that's a valid point. And, it was good of him to bring it up, but it would have been a whole lot better if he tied that in with some sort of comment, at least addressing the question directly, rather than trying to do a very blatant deflection. And that was actually the source of kind of the one heckle during the night.
Yeah, there were lots of people who were really pissed at him for dodging that question.
Yeah, it was definitely, I think, the low moment for him during the night. And the thing is, it's not even that hard a question to dodge. A political staffer doesn't set government policy. And he did say, we did a lot of great stuff, but, we could have done a lot better on the housing file, and that's what I'm going to fight for. And there's ways of downplaying how much decision-making role he had there and going off and into the point about Vision dropping
the ball.
Well,
even possibly playing up the fact that he was involved at the provincial level, so he knows how the systems there work. And even if they're changed slightly under the NDP, he still has some experience with that, so he could be a better advocate from the city's point of view than someone with no provincial experience at all. So there are strengths there that he could have played up. But instead, most of his time talking felt like the slick, overly polished politician. He had some great talking points in there. He was really good at pounding home three specific ideas. He was the get to yes candidate.
Yeah, that's the other thing that was kind of interesting is the NPA is a kind of center-right party, so to speak, in Vancouver, as much as the left-right spectrum easily maps onto municipal politics, which it really doesn't, but they are there, and yet he was probably the most kumbaya of the bunch, even more than Gene Swanson, who was actually very us versus them in a lot of ways. But yeah, Hector was all about, let's come together and, you know, link arms and, you know, get to yes.
Link arms and approve every development and speed up processes, which makes more sense. But
I think he's being very optimistic if he thinks that just tweaking the consultation process is going to ease things up. Because having been to a few of those council meetings where people come out to speak on projects, it's not a pleasant environment, to say the least. And I don't think just engaging people slightly better at it is going to change it. And I was at one for a social housing unit in Mount Pleasant, and everybody came out to oppose it. And it's always the, oh, of course we support this, but just not here. And I don't see how any better consultation is going to get by that.
Hector Bremner was also the one who brought up evidence-based policy a couple times, but it almost just came across as rhetoric rather than, here's why evidence supports my position as opposed to anyone else's. And he could make that argument.
He did cite a few examples. The Sydney thing we mentioned earlier.
Although it comes across a little tacky when you talk about iPads involved, even though that does make it stick in our heads a bit better.
Yeah, the point was, he brought up a few things that on the rent control question, referencing the Toronto thing we talked about last week before. So there's a few cases where he definitely cited examples to back up his points when talking about that, but there were also times that did come across more as a talking point than anything else.
Yeah, he was good at falling back on the same things, but
He has just kind of that too much of a politician thing going for him.
And that all comes back to Vision's initial attack on him, which was just a few months ago when he was speaking on the no side of a consultation because the debate was actually just across the street from where he lives. And
also across the street from where the proposed development was going to go.
So he's got that history that becomes a bit more tangible in that specific forum.
Yeah, although it didn't actually come up that night.
I don't think that was a very pro-development room in any case.
The one thing I did like during the debate was Tom Dehavetoff keep trying to feed this question to the candidates about, okay, if you can get a crazy amount of money building market units on and just selling them in the market on city land, would it be better just to then take that money and distribute it amongst people rather than effectively having a lottery for a few
who
people
gets to get into the...
Yeah, and it was, yeah, the hypothetical was basically, okay, if you're this thing is basically worth $1 billion of market rate unit, whatever the number was, it was like $1 billion-ish a mark, or like 1,000 market rate. Anyway, doesn't really matter. The point is, you can get all this money. Is giving 1,000 people a home a better use of that $1 billion than helping everybody at the low end of the income spectrum with a cash transfer? And it was disappointing no one bid on it.
Well, it's one of those hypothetical economist questions that politicians just don't want to deal with. And not just because they come from different ideological spectrum parts and have different approaches on it. But I feel like for each of them, none of them even really like didn't just deal with it, but found like the nice bullet or whatever. Like from Jean Swanson's point of view, she could just say, if the government is selling buildings, where are the people going to live then? If you just give these people money, you've sold the places that you could have been putting them in. At least you know you've housed 1,000 people. And if you just keep housing people and taxing the rich, like why is the government in the housing retail business? There's the sort of right-wing argument there that the government's not effective at selling things. And it's not clear the government has enough money. There's lots of arguments you can use to sort of pick apart that hypothetical. It was very amusing to see him bring that up to everyone. And a couple twice, I think, just to really try to see if anyone would play with his game.
Yeah, I did appreciate the professor coming through in a few moments. But I would have loved it if they dived a little more into the wonkiness of those sorts of things, but yeah, it's a debate among politicians, so it's not likely to happen.
Well, there's one more day of advance voting on October 10th, and then the official election day is on October 14th. And other than your council candidate, who, if you didn't like any of these, there's a few independents as well you could vote for, you also get to vote for up to 9 school board trustees. And we went through most of the major ones a couple episodes ago. So make sure you vote in the by-election if you're able to.
Moving on to our next segment, Jade Meat, the new face of the NDP. So, the 4-round leadership race turned out not to be 4 rounds for the NDP, as we got a new leader for the party this week.
Well, it was never going to go to 4 rounds because you have 4 candidates, so at most it could have mathematically got to 3 ballots. But yes, it was still a surprise, at least to me, that Jagmeet Singh took 53.8% of the votes on the first ballot. The NDP on Sunday afternoon had their vote counting announcement in Toronto, just actually across the street, I think, from the Jack Layton Ferry Terminal, which I only know is a thing because on their little event page, they had a map and that was labeled on there. I think that was just Google Maps labeled it, not an active NDP conspiracy. But it's a very small room. The event itself, because I watched, looked like it only held maybe 100 people. I've heard a few people describe it as kind of like shamily put together, and
they weren't inspecting it.
And they really dragged it out with speeches.
While you were live streaming this at home, I was sitting waiting for a flight out of Kingston. And yeah, constantly checking Twitter. It's like, oh, okay, the thing's scheduled for, I think it was 2:30 it was going to start local time. 2:30 or 3, I can't recall. And I was like, oh, I'll check Twitter. And I was like, okay. Kept going back. I think I ended up just constantly refreshing Twitter for an hour rather than reading the book I had open.
Because they had Olivia Chow speak, and then I think Alexandre Boularis, who was shockingly charming. Like, I watched him speak in both French and English. I think actually his speech was mostly in English, but I now get why people wished he was running for leadership, because man's got some charm. Then they had the party executives or whatever come up on stage, and they're like, we'll announce ballots, but first we have to thank literally everyone here. And so they finally got to it maybe 20 minutes after. And they nicely listed candidates in alphabetical order, which puts Singh at the end of the list, so it was a little bit of drama. There were 65,782 ballots cast, which was, I think, about 52 or 53% turnout, which feels like it's really bad, but for a leadership race, it's on par, I think, with the Conservatives. It's on par with the NDP's last leadership convention.
Yeah, so leadership races have a lot of membership sales as a major part of the campaign, but you know, these are also the people who are least likely to vote because, well, they weren't a member up until the election, so they're not that invested in the party. And you know, you're generally pretty lucky if you can get 50% of them to show up for your candidate.
On the other factor for the NDP is you have people who signed up for the Manitoba leadership race, who are signing up for the Saskatchewan leadership race, who signed up for the BC election, and who signed up for all these provincial parties and are now also members of the federal party but may not give a damn about it. And you have the leadership candidates fighting against that apathy to try to get more people out. So reasonably good job on getting that turnout. It seems like that turnout might have just been largely driven by Jagmeet Singh's own campaign. It's hard to tell, but he did get 35,000 votes, or 53.8%, as I mentioned, whereas Charlie Angus got 12,705, Nikki Ashton got 11,374, and Guy Caron rounded it out with just over 6,000 votes. So Caron, I think, performed about where expected, maybe a little bit below. Nikki Ashton, I think, performed a bit above expectations. She definitely outperformed the 5% she got in the last leadership race. But Charlie Angus is where, at least for me personally, the 19% that he got in this race, almost on par with Nikki Ashton, who got 17%, was a surprisingly low result for him.
Yeah, I think everyone is expecting him to get minimum mid-20s, probably high 20s, low 30s. So finishing in the teens was unexpectedly bad.
And it's, I guess, just the enthusiasm of Jagmeet's team that managed to not necessarily mean Charlie didn't get his voters out, but just didn't bring more people into the party. And honestly, if a party wants to go forward, it needs to keep bringing people in. So there was some criticism from the other camps of Jagmeet focusing very heavily on suburbs of Toronto and Vancouver. But if that wins you a leadership vote where it's just who gets the most votes, not balanced by riding, you can run away with it.
Yeah, this is actually kind of interesting in that it's basically the exact opposite strategy that Scheer took in his campaign, where Scheer basically didn't sell any memberships and spent the membership selling window campaigning to the base. Whereas from the looks of it, Jagmeet got in a lot of new members and had a much higher sign-up number than any of his competitors.
Yeah, well, he in the summer was bragging about the 47,000 people he signed up. So obviously he didn't get them all to churn out. But whether he got 35,000 of them to churn out, or if he got half of them to churn out plus a bunch of existing members, whatever ratio it was, and we'll never know the math, Jagmeet's team might have a sense of that number, but they're not going to share it. It was a winning strategy, and it was ultimately victorious for him. And full credit, it's good for a political party to have a one ballot win, because then you don't have this. I think the Conservatives have gotten past any ill feelings from the leadership race, but the Liberals had that Stéphane Dion come from behind win, and there were still the sort of Bob Rae and Michael Ignatieff knives like waiting to be leader for the entire time, and Stéphane Dion kind of underperformed. And when you have that tension of, oh, did they really deserve to win because the party split right down the middle like that?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Maxime Bernier's still thinking about what happens should Scheer not do all that great. Yeah, they don't seem to have those knives out quite yet, but there's also, I think, a sense from a bunch of people who are kind of more on the center end that Scheer's been a bit of a disappointment. So, we'll have to see how that goes. But it seems to be the opposite of how the NDP are feeling right now, who are pretty happy with the results.
Yeah, each of the teams has embraced it. No one's really questioning it. One of Jagmeet's first acts was to appoint Guy Caron as his parliamentary leader. Jagmeet Singh obviously doesn't have a seat in parliament, and he's not in a big rush to get one. He's not going to ask anyone to step down, and if a by-election comes up, that's right, he might jump into it. I think he's hoping for a suburban riding to put the pressure on the Liberals, if he could take that, or take it from a Conservative, really. But having Guy Caron is a nice olive branch to the person who he said was his second choice, personally, but also to all the people, even though it was only 9% who supported him. I think a lot of people had Guy Caron sitting second on their ballot, which is also why he's only at 9%.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if the party actually releases those numbers, because it'd be really curious to see where the second and third choices lined up.
We're never going to see those numbers.
Yeah, unfortunately not, but I kind of want to.
Charlie and Nikki don't have any formal positions yet, unless they've been given back the roles they had before they resigned them before the leadership race. But I think Jagmeet's still sussing out his parliamentary caucus to figure out if he wants to shuffle a shadow cabinet in there. Otherwise, it's just the same as it was under Mulcair, with, I guess, Mulcair now a backbencher.
Well, he also has announced his intended retirement from federal politics, so he probably won't be a backbencher much longer.
And I know one of the other things Jagmeet also did to reach out in his victory speech right away is he was already mentioning Guy Caron's basic income plan. I think we're seeing Jagmeet make sure he includes policies from each of the different camps so that everyone who has got engaged in this leadership debate and who saw a good idea wherever it came from feels it's still part of the party and they stay. So it's promising. Jagmeet's got a fantastic media profile relative to any of the other candidates, and it's the NDP's shot to lose right now. But how do you think that's going to position them, let's say, against the Justin Trudeau Liberals or the Andrew Scheer Conservatives? Because now Justin Trudeau is the oldest major party leader in the House. He's not as old as Elizabeth May.
Yeah, so this is a point that has not gone unremarked upon. Basically, every pundit has talked about it at some point.
And now we have to.
Yes. I also think a few of them actually kind of just forgot Elizabeth May was there. Which, yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, so it does kind of make an interesting challenge for Justin Trudeau, because he can't do the I'm the young, exciting guy here to change things up. He could never run the I'm going to change things up campaign as a re-election one, but he also now doesn't have the youth thing going for him as much. I think it makes the Conservatives' job a little easier to have a charming, charismatic guy on the left to steal votes from the Liberals.
There was that discussion I've heard out there about Conservative joke of they should sign up to support Jagmeet to divide the left with a successful NDP, because the argument is that Conservatives do best when the NDP has Ed Broadbent or has Jack Layton in ascension and are as popular or more popular than the Liberals, in which case they can march through and take all the split votes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance it's going to happen. 2019 is a little ways out, but I don't see Scheer being super effective on the campaign trail, kind of reaching outside the core base. So I'm not sure how successful it's going to be, and I think they will really have to ride on that division.
Well, yeah, I see Scheer being almost a liability for some of the suburban seats that are shifting to be a little bit more progressive or multicultural. And then you have Jagmeet Singh, who none of these suburban seats like Surrey would never have gone NDP, but now you have large Sikh communities there that are aware of him and are interested in his politics, and now the NDP becomes a possibility. So you could have major realignments with downtown cores now being Liberal NDP battlefields, suburbs being three-way battlefields at time, Conservatives still taking most of the rural seats, maybe even a few more, since some of them might not be a fan of Jagmeet. Northern BC, he'll probably still be fine, but I guess the prairies were out for the NDP for a while. And then Quebec becomes the other question, because there's this floating question of, is Quebec too racist to elect a person of color who also wears visible religious symbols?
Well, we did get a bit of a hint of that when the Angus Reid, who put out a poll on the question. So they asked, would you vote for a Sikh man who wears a turban and carries a kippah? And Quebec came in at 53% on that one, which is not great, but...
So nationwide, 69% of Canadians said, yes, they would vote for someone who's Sikh and wears visible stuff. And BC was 77%, the most accepting of it. But yeah, Quebec, 53%. And that becomes a problem for the NDP, which their path to victory after 2011 feels like it involves Quebec. At the same time, one of the other things that came out of that survey was that 50% of people think some or most of their close family or friends could not vote for such a person. So this is almost one of those weird situations where everyone thinks everyone else is a little less tolerant than them, which is, I guess, how Canada works. We all think we're really tolerant, but everyone else has a bit of a racist uncle.
Well, it's also a question of some. Like, we don't know how much overlap there is in that number. But yeah, it does seem to be interesting that the number of people who say they would vote for is higher than the number that they think everyone else would. So
I think Jagmeet Singh's familiarity numbers with Canadians were also pretty low in this survey, but they did, I think, put that in context with Andrew Scheer, who even fewer people had heard of when he won, so...
And hasn't done a great job at changing the... Like, he's made some improvements, but yeah, his numbers have not been great on that.
So at least Jagmeet Singh has been in the media for the past few months, and this past week, he's had even more media since winning. He was tweeted... Well, he wasn't tweeted, but CBC journalist Susan Bonner tweeted a picture of a Sikh man and said, "This is Canada's newest federal party leader scrumming in Ottawa." Only it happened to be, I think it's Infrastructure Minister Navdeep Bains.
That's okay. I mean, who would expect a journalist at the CBC to know what a minister looks like?
Well, she did correctly identify Chris Hall, a radio pundit, from the back of his head. So she can do some recognition. She oddly tried to defend her tweet, saying, oh, no, no, Navdeep was talking about Jagmeet, so that's what she meant by saying this is the party leader scrumming. She then later apologized and deleted both tweets. This was sort of compounded by a weird follow-up of questions around whether Jagmeet Singh will unequivocally condemn the Air India bombings of the 1980s, I think it was.
Real relevant question for this day and age.
So the Air India bombings, for anyone who doesn't remember, because I assume most of our listeners are millennials like us and don't remember them because we might not have been alive or weren't that old at the time.
I wasn't alive because it was 5 years before I was born.
But the Air India bombings was Sikh separatists, essentially, who lived in Canada but had moved here from India, who wanted to essentially advocate and fight for and commit terrorist acts to get a Sikh state in North India. And they blew up a plane. And it was Canada's most devastating terrorist incident in history. And Terry Maleski, who's a CBC longtime pundit and who's covered Air India bombings at the time and done a few follow-ups, including, I think, something called Samosa Politics, which is a problematic name for a documentary, but I guess it's not as bad as it sounds. He was filling in for Power and Politics for some reason, and he decided to just hound Singh on the question of, will you condemn the Air India bombings? And I guess there was one Vaisakhi parade, which is a Sikh festival, where they had a float filled with pictures of martyrs, because martyrdom is a big thing in Sikh culture. And one of the Air India bomber architects' photo was up there, which is problematic. We shouldn't celebrate people who blow up masses of people. But at no point in his entire career has Jagmeet Singh suggested, as far as I know, any sympathies or supports with Sikh separatists or terrorists. And I feel like the only reason they asked him that is because he wears a turban. And his refusal to say, no, you're an idiot, Terry, right away, because I think Singh took the similar approach to when the racist heckler started screaming at him, and instead of just saying to her, no, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not bringing in Sharia law, he just said, no, we love and accept you. And he later clarified, he said he didn't say he wasn't a Muslim because he's not trying to throw Muslims under the bus. He's against bigots. So when a bigot throws a bad question at him, he's going to dodge the question and take a different tact. And I think that's what he did here. But now you have the Toronto Sun and people in the Montreal Gazette, I guess, even saying, well, new NDP leader doesn't unequivocally condemn terrorism. And that's where we're at now, because it's 2017. So I think this is the start rather than the end of the fun we're going to have with a first person of color leading a major political party in Canada at the federal level.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing is I've seen several, you know, the headlines, you know, nobody knows how to or the media doesn't know how to handle this stuff. And they're being provincial leaders of color before, so why is... Can they not just go through the same stuff they did all those other times? Or is it that bad then?
Or they're a politician. Just ask them questions about politics. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Or if you need to make it a race thing, yeah. Ujjal Dosanjh was premier of BC and then federal health minister. What questions do you ask him? How about questions about health or how BC is doing?
Yeah, treating this as unprecedented is kind of weird.
Like, I think it's worth acknowledging the breaking of ground on it and the first time of that.
Of course.
That's nice. But then going beyond that, you're right.
Like treating it as unprecedented, like, yeah, true at the federal level, but like the core of how does the media interact with that person shouldn't be.
I think when I saw Jagmeet speak in Burnaby a couple of weeks ago, one of the things he talked about was, yes, if he wins, he'll be the first, but he stands on the shoulders of other people who've broken trails. And he, I think, mentioned Rosemary Brown, and right outside this apartment where we're at is Rosemary Brown Park. And she was the first black woman to sit in the BC legislature. So he is specifically aware of all of the people who came before him and broke racial barriers and other barriers. So I'm excited for Jagmeet. He wasn't my pick, but he was frankly number two on my ballot, and he'd risen there because he impressed me, and so I'm excited to see where this goes. Next up, we're going to squeeze a third segment in tonight. Seth Rogen for electoral reform. The BC government this week announced its framework for how it's going to get us to our referendum on proportional representation. But what became a mini weird media story was CBC's decision to run a photo from May of David Eby on the doorsteps, but it happened to be Seth Rogen's doorstep. So you have David Eby, Seth Rogen, and a random campaign volunteer all smiling awkwardly at this camera, just being like, David Eby promoting proportional representation during the election. And people started tweeting at him like, is this you? And he's just like, yes, don't ask.
Yeah, so this was just a really kind of bizarre editorial choice on CBC's part. I'm kind of wondering what was going on in the minds there. Just like, they had to know that was Seth Rogen, right? Like, and who decided, oh, this is the thing that should go with electoral reform, but somehow it is. And hey, if Seth wants to come on the podcast and talk electoral reform, he is more than welcome to. I'm sure he listens. That would be, you know, hey, if you are listening, you know, hit us up. We'll be happy to talk electoral politics and weed politics.
Absolutely. So in the actual announcement, David Eby, as Attorney General, who was given this task as well as half the other tasks, it seemed like, announced that rather than tie the vote with the municipal election, which is what was promised initially, it's going to be a mail-in ballot that occurs in the fall of next year. The argument being that it was worth flip-flopping because it's actually still cheaper to do a mail-in ballot than to try to tie them together. There was also some hints they might have been worried about low turnout at the municipal election, and I guess there are different voter lists a little bit. So it seems like a reasonable enough, you know, we should go to mail-in ballot rather than this. They've also set this threshold of 50% plus one to adopt a new system, but they've also not committed to having a simple yes or no, should we go to MMP or stick with first past the post. There could be a multiple option question, as they did in PEI recently, and that resulted in a low turnout, unclear result that they then walked away from. Nevertheless, when I was listening to Inside BC Politics with Shane Woodford and Vaughn Palmer and all the other main media correspondents, they all deemed this a surefire bet to ram through proportional representation. Residents of the interior be damned.
Because they've apparently never watched one of these ballots happen before.
Well, their argument is proportional representation advocates just keep pushing through ballots through until they win, and we'll just have to keep voting on it forever and ever. And I don't really get why they were so bitter or attached to first past the post. But in any case, we'll have this ballot. The open-endedness of the legislation feels like it's mostly just so they can get something on the table, and rather than restrict themselves to having to stick to one question, if it comes down to let's get multiple things on the ballot, let's figure that out. Because this is really just setting the framework so they can start consultations, come up with a question, and get it in place so they can run this referendum, because the clock is ticking.
Yeah, these things take a little time now. The only question is, are we going to get one of those adorably horrible websites to consult people with?
This feels more serious than Justin Trudeau's committee that he then decided to do nothing with, because this is actually legislation requiring a referendum, and it will be a mail-in rather than online ballot. So, and I don't think Vox Pop Labs, no offense to them, is involved at all. The other big challenge, I guess, is that whatever system they do decide on, if we decide to change at the end of next year, we'll have to be in place for the 2021 election, assuming the
government lasts that long.
Exactly. And the awkward question then becomes, if the government falls, we have to use the current system. Does the next government then beholden to use the new system? It would be a really terrible election. So the other thing they were trying to talk about is, does this tie the hands of the Greens to stick with the NDP until 2021?
Yeah, strategically it might, because there really is no mechanism for the legislature to say to the next legislature, no, you can't change the law on this one.
We'd basically spend an entire election debating electoral reform after having had a referendum on it. And I could see the Liberals wanting to go back, maybe.
Depends who their leader is.
Are any of the leadership candidates for electoral reform at this point?
I'm actually not sure on that, but the Liberals have put out two ballots in the past on the question. They were more supportive of it back in the early 2000s when
the
losses
of...
were a little more fresh, but I could see someone like Sam Sullivan maybe sticking with it and a few of those people, but it's hard to say.
It's worth noting those losses. I think the big one was, I think, the 96 election, where the Liberals won significantly more votes, like a few percent. It was a U.S. Electoral College style situation where they won lots more votes, but the NDP won lots more seats because of the way the math worked.
Yeah, and stuff like that's why you have longtime NDP partisans like Bill Tilleman coming out hard against electoral reform in the past, and I'm pretty sure he's still coming out pretty strong against it this time. So,
a lot of the establishment really hates electoral reform, but in this case, it seems like
their hand's kind of forced because of the seat count.
Well, and the NDP has committed to campaign in favor of electoral reform, which they did before the election. They've stuck with that. And this legislation, I don't think we can read too much into, but it is the first step. And the fact it is one of the first bills, it comes right after campaign finance reform and the budget and the throne speech. It couldn't come much faster than this. So they are treating this seriously. And I think they're treating it more seriously than the Trudeau Liberals did, for sure. And they also haven't mealy-mouthed their way into just doing ranked ballots if that's what no one else wants.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where I think you can only really have the sort of reform in a minority government, because any other situation, the party would have benefited getting it in, with the possible exception of when there's a very fresh wound or... yeah, lingering there, like with the BC Liberals in the early 2000s. But other than that, having a third party partner on this to kind of hold their feet to the fire is, I think, kind of what's needed.
So we'll keep our eyes for the consultation process on that, since it's probably coming up pretty quick. I think our electoral reform deep dive, which was done 8 months ago or something, or more.
I think it was closer to 10.
It's still a good listen, I think, in terms of looking at all the possible models that we could take on. We did that discussion with Lead Now on the federal level, but...
it's effectively applicable to BC.
Just change every time we said Canada to BC, and it's basically the same. The other things introduced this week was a piece of legislation to amend the BC Constitution Act, and that would move our fixed election date to October instead of May. Interestingly, elections would then be on Saturdays rather than Tuesdays. And this is, I guess, a way to get around the, we should make voting day a holiday since it would be a weekend. Not everyone has weekends off, but more people have weekends off than Tuesdays. Like, I like the idea of fall elections. It might run up against federal or other elections in some years if the timing gets off, but otherwise, it just seems to make more sense with the budgeting process. And they're also doing the Greens a favor by reducing the requirement for official party status from 4 seats to 2. So even if the Greens lose a member, they'll still be an official party. It also means even if the NDP gets reduced to 2 seats again, which has happened, they'll still be an official party. And those were both parts of the confidence and supply agreement that the Greens also made red lines, and I think are pretty easy, uncontroversial things to pass. That doesn't mean the Liberals won't vote against them. We saw the Liberals this week, I think, vote against sending the campaign finance reform bill to committee because rather than try to fix it, they just wanted to kill it at this point. So they're learning how to oppose, I guess.
Moving on, quick takes. The US has another bee in its bonnet on the trade file. Specifically this time regarding BC wines, and they filed a WTO, World Trade Organization, complaint about BC's unfair wine practices. Specifically, this is the store within a store wine thing in supermarkets where only BC wines are allowed to be displayed.
So the BC Liberals brought in a few in their last year or two of government, a few reforms to our liquor laws that in theory allowed alcohol to be sold in grocery stores, or at least beer and wine. Unfortunately, those rules are still so restrictive that there's a handful of stores around the province.
I have never actually encountered one of these.
I think there's only a couple in the Lower Mainland, and they're mostly in Coquitlam or the suburbs. But part of that was we should promote BC wines because we're really proud of them and buy local and all that stuff. But at the time, it raised this question of, under NAFTA, won't that piss off the Americans who say they should not have their wines hidden in the back? And this is the inevitable result. I don't know enough about all of the inner workings of these trade deals to know who's going to win. It's fun that the NDP now gets to deal with this headache of a rollout. This feels like it could have been done just a bit better to avoid this. Or maybe it was inevitable that when you say we're going to have a sign that says these are BC wines and they're great, that you're going to piss off Americans.
They're not entirely off base with having a reasonable complaint here that singling out BC wines by law is kind of against the spirit and, well, the text of NAFTA.
The question it has me thinking about, though, as we move towards cannabis legalization, is if we get weed in stores in some form or another, will there be some push to have BC Bud on better display, or will we allow the importation of Washington weed, and will there be a trade dispute over that?
I think we can pretty safely rule out the idea that the administration, which Jeff Sessions and Mike Pence are a part of, are going to be going to bat for the weed producers of America. But you still have the NAFTA Chapter 11, where companies can file legal actions against countries. And this might get into an interesting situation where, you know, weed producers from Colorado and Washington are taking the BC government or the Ontario government to court.
Unfortunately, I think the current rules they're setting up aren't allowing international trade on this, but let's hope for this case because we want to hear about Washington High Times suing the BC government. Well, the BC Conservatives, who are our favorite fringe party to check in on, have appointed an interim leader and launched a new website.
So the old website was notoriously terrible. Well, would be notoriously terrible if anyone had ever visited it, but it was everything bad about websites circa early 2000s.
It became a literal segment on our show one day when we were low on content, and I found it and I was like, this goes in. This goes in now because it's so bad.
Yeah, so they upgraded it to a semi-competent execution of the Nation Builder platform, but
other than leaving the login buttons everywhere.
Hence the semi-competent. So they've cleaned up their act a bit and are now at least appearing moderately professional, but they're still very much a fringe party, even with a new leader.
So their leader is Vernon City Councillor Scott Anderson, who I think was speaking as their, before they even had an interim leader during the election, he was speaking as their policy director or something else. So he's been involved for a little bit. There'll be a proper election for their next leader in 2018. And if they're smart, they'll hold it after the BC Liberals so they can try and pick up disaffected Liberals, or at least on the right, if they aren't there. It looks like with their new website, they're trying to really tie themselves to a broader federal conservative movement that's also in the UCP in Alberta. That one of their big petitions right now is to scrap the, quote, BC Liberal imposed carbon tax, which it's always good to be fighting the last government. They have registered scrapthecarbontax.ca, and there you can find quotes from Stephen Harper, Rona Ambrose, Andrew Scheer, Brian Jean, Jason Kenney, Brad Wall, the, like, luminaries of the right of Canada about why they all hate carbon taxes.
Yeah, so this also comes on the heels of the renaming of the party. So yeah, it to be more in line with the nomenclature of other conservative parties in Canada. So it does look like they're trying to go for that riding of the coattails.
And then otherwise, they've cleaned up their platform on their website to just be about repealing carbon taxes, reforming MSP, supporting all of the energy things, Kinder Morgan, LNG, thermal coal, also limiting political contributions to individuals. Doesn't say a finite amount that an individual can donate. And opposing the George Massey Bridge / support twinning the tunnel.
So, you know, they're in good company with the Greens on that. I'm sure they'll get on swimmingly. But sadly, the monorail doesn't seem to have gotten nearly as much play as their last website.
I guess we'll have to see who donates to them between now and the next election about whether that makes it into their next policy commitment.
Moving on to federal politics, the Liberal Party struck a blow for the right of a woman to choose by forcing a woman to do something she didn't want to do. Specifically, this is about the shenanigans involving the chairmanship of the Status of Women Committee. So this is one of the few committees which the opposition parties get the chairmanship of. And I'm sure our friends, the Boys in Short Pants, will be doing a detailed examination of how committee chairs work and everything. But the long and the short of it is the Conservative Party put up Rachel Harder, a well-known anti-abortion MP, to head up the committee, and, well, the Liberals were having none of that and basically quashed the nomination. And in the process, they voted Karen Vecchio into the position, but there was the slight complication that she explicitly said she didn't want the post. So you have this very bad bit of political optics where you're standing up for women's choice while forcing a woman to do something she doesn't want to do.
The Liberals were they put themselves in the tough position once they decided to oppose Harder's appointment. The Conservatives put Harder up as their Status of Women critic, which is why they wanted her to be committee chair of the Status of Women Committee, since it's her portfolio and she would be well versed in it. The problem is she has been on record as being endorsed by the Campaign Life Coalition in one election and has supported bills that would restrict a woman's right to choose an abortion. So once the Liberals decided they didn't want Harder, they had only two other Conservatives on this committee to essentially vote for. They had Karen Vecchio, or they could go to Martin Shields. I'm not sure it might actually look worse to put up a man, despite his amazing mustache, and I definitely encourage you to Google Martin Shields and check out his bartender from the Old West. He represents Brooks, Alberta, so I'm assuming that's where he worked before. Actually, he was a teacher, but he's not the stereotypical image of the Status of Women's Committee, especially if the liberal feminist agenda is trying to be up there, or at least the image. So they ended up going with Karen, and because the Liberals had a majority, they've had to vote for her. And the NDP member also voted along with them. Where this all got even more dramatic is the Liberals were actually walking out of the committee to force this vote to happen for whatever reason. Just really hamming up the almost, if you don't go our way, we just won't even sit in this committee kind of thing.
There'll be no status for women.
And then you even had Justin Trudeau telling a news conference that his government is in support of the independence of committees, and the Liberals there just made this decision to walk out on their own.
Which, you know, sits MPs don't walk out on their own and capture a media cycle without someone higher up saying something about it.
Maybe it was their decision. He just approved of it once asked. Maybe it was their idea. So this is, I think, just a week of messy news that is really good at capturing Ottawa Hill watchers, but I don't know that anyone outside of it really cares, except maybe the advocates on either side of the abortion debate.
Yeah, the irony of the whole situation got a fair bit of play on social media, but Yeah, I'm not sure how many people outside of it really noticed too much.
There was the standard irate Andrew Coyne column. I mean, he doesn't have a standard irate one, but it's a, like...
There's a greatest hits list.
It's like a moral indignation of, this isn't how Parliament is supposed to work. And just kind of goes, I read a bit of it and I was like, oh God, you're getting too Coyne. It was a Pete Coyne column. And I like a decent number of Coyne columns for a conservative, but that one I was just like, maybe I just don't like the whole controversy. Maybe it's just dumb and doesn't... Not that the committee is important, but this whole controversy was dumb.
Yeah, and that is the thing about this is, you know, this probably was not well played by really anyone very well. The Liberals look like they're not coming through for the core value they're supposed to be supporting. The Conservatives look a little impotent in the whole thing, and it's just not a great look for anyone out of this. And honestly, in the long term, it probably would have been better just to let Harder stick around. And, you know, there's a lot of fundraising emails you could probably get out of the stuff she would say there. And yeah, it's a good source of potential bozo eruptions to hammer the Conservatives on.
Well, the other rough news for the federal Liberals this week was that TransCanada decided to pull the plug on the Energy East pipeline. The Liberals had initially approved this as one of the pipelines they were celebrating the agreement to get it through. And now TransCanada looked at, well, what they told the National Energy Board is they looked at existing and likely future delays from the regulatory process, associated cost implications, and increasingly challenging issues and obstacles facing the project, and decided it wasn't worth continuing. The price of oil when they started this project in 2013 was over $100 a barrel, and now it's under $50. So the economics get a lot harder. They've sunk over $1 billion in this project, but would have been facing $16 billion to finish it. So it's in the realm of Site C level difficult board decisions to make.
Yeah, of course, this one, it's just the investors that have to pay for it, so it's slightly better on that front. It's also worth remembering that Energy East was kind of the most recent proposal, and it kind of only really came around after the other ones, Northern Gateway, Trans Mountain, Keystone, were all kind of stuck in the quagmire that is pipeline approvals, and Energy East seemed like the easy win because it was mostly an existing pipeline. They were going to reverse it, put the bit of new piping, but like overall it was supposed to be the easier sell on it, even if it didn't make a huge amount of sense to be going from Alberta to the East Coast rather than the West Coast or the Gulf Coast.
Well, and there was a lot of opposition in Quebec to this pipeline. I know a number of mayors, I think including Denis Coderre in Montreal.
Oh, he was leading the charge.
Were all against it. So that plus a number of indigenous groups who are against it and environmentalists who are strongly against it, they're all now cheering and using this as a symbol of what their resistance can help them do potentially as the fight over Kinder Morgan ramps up.
And finally, on defense and foreign relations news, Canada's announced they're deploying a submarine to Asia, specifically the HMS Chicoutimi, which is most famous for catching fire. And it's one of the four Victoria-class subs we bought from the British back in 2003. And it's kind of doing its first major deployment to Asia. Now, the government wasn't exactly forthcoming with the details of what it will be doing or even where besides the general vicinity of Asia.
I mean, the point of a submarine is that you don't know where it is. It's underwater and hidden. So I get it. That's fine.
This is a very reasonable bit of secrecy on their part. But this is most notable because, well, the subs haven't really deployed very much, if at all. And Asia is not a place they've gone before. So it's interesting in that respect.
Yeah, the sub is as old as I am and has been in Canada for 15 years, I think, roughly, and has now been active for two. It's had an interesting life, including the fire you mentioned, so it's good to see it on its, I guess, maiden Canadian voyage.
Yeah, so we, like I said, we don't really know what's going on with the deployment. Korea wouldn't be an unreasonable guess on this one, but it's probably going to be part of some joint task force sort of thing, but we'll just have to see.
Or you more mean, hopefully we won't see, because if its mission is successful and there's no war with North Korea, it won't have to surface ever, and it can just return home, and everything is fine.
And that has been Politros. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politros.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitrosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politros. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.